Calling our second case this morning, 19 AP 1365 Danielle Duncan versus Asset Recovery Specialists, Inc. We have Justice Ann Welsh Bradley appearing by phone this morning, so we'll be listening with a keen ear in case we hear her unmute herself so that we can then attend to her and her questions she might want to ask. Counsel, could you make your appearances, please?
For the petitioner, defendant to respond, this attorney Bill for the police.
Thank you. All right. The lineup I have is Mr. Erke, your 25 minutes, save 5 minutes in rebuttal. 30 minutes for Mr. Pegg. All right, please proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, good morning. I've introduced myself. I am representing Asset Recovery Specialists, the repossession agent in this matter, Greg Strandley, its owner and employee who did the repossession, and Wells Fargo Bank, which is the lender in the matter. This is a case, as you know, that the trial court granted summary judgment dismissal. The Court of Appeals reversed, and we are now here asking you to overturn the Court of Appeals and reinstate what we believe the trial court properly did. We are addressing two main issues here, and I think as I head into those two issues, it's important to hit on just a couple of factual reminders as the basis leading into the first argument, which is primarily the statutory language we're addressing. This is a case where the plaintiff had defaulted on her loan, and the lender had, without undisputed, had the right to the vehicle. It's undisputed that the repossession agent, Mr. Strandley, and his assistant entered an open garage door that remained open before, during, and after the repossession, which took anywhere from 7 to 10 minutes. They removed the vehicle while a maintenance man from the apartment complex was present. And the space they went into had room for 56 vehicles and access for 56 vehicles and at least 56 people. The car was taken from one of those 56 parking spots from the area on a ground floor of a building where there were no apartments, there were no living spaces, and there was no residential activity. No one lived on that ground floor, and for anyone entering or leaving the garage, they would need two keys to get out of the garage, go up the stairs, and then use a second key to get into what was truly their residential area. Also, the parking spot that we're talking about was obtained by the plaintiff, Ms. Duncan, separately from the lease she signed for her residential apartment. So why is that all important? Question number one here is whether Mr. Strandley and his assistant entered a dwelling used by this customer as a residence in removing the car from the first floor parking area. If they enter a dwelling used by the customer as a residence, it is a violation of the statute 425.206 section, subsection 2B. And we submit that in this repossession, in January of 2016, they did not enter a dwelling. The garage was not a dwelling. It was not used by the customer as a residence, and it certainly was not a residence as that term is commonly known.
Is a garage attached to a single-family home a dwelling within the meaning of the statute?
Well, I had anticipated the question, and That's a hypothetical, because the way that the Court of Appeals mentioned that, Justice Bradley, was, well, if we rule in a certain way, will that affect if your agents or an agent goes into a single-family residence? And I have to answer by on a twofold, one legal, one factual basis. One, I refer the Court to a case, Tammy versus Porsche, 768 Northwest 2nd, 783, where a similar question was asked about how will this apply to a separate set of different factual circumstances? In that case, hypothetical. And I perceive a question about, is a single family residence with an attached garage, does that garage constitute a dwelling? I quote Tammy versus Porsche by saying, as resolution of an issue such as that, Justice, depends on hypothetical or future facts that are not ripe for adjudication and will not be addressed by the court. That was this court that indicated that, I believe, in Tammy versus Porsche. And also I cite Voss versus City of Madison that emphasizes the determination in this case is limited to the precise facts and circumstances of this case. In a different case, the statute might have to be interpreted or construed differently. With that legal response, Justice, I would say that under the facts here, if you have a garage attached to a single-family residence, but there is no one dwelling or living in there with the basic indicia, my secondary factual response would be, I do not believe it is a dwelling used by the customer as a residence. But again, I rely more, quite frankly and quite honestly, on the legal aspect of those kind of cases would have so many and such different facts than the true facts we have here.
So, counsel, just to follow your argument all the way through, and if the repossession company wanted to repossess a vehicle, they would have to peer inside of a garage, and apparently one attached to a single-family home, to determine if there was a bed in there, or to determine if there's a couch in there, or how would they ever know, under your reading of dwelling, what is a dwelling for purposes of this statute?
Well, the dwelling for the purposes of this statute is where people actually live. The definition that I was and will get to in the context of the statute, they actually live, they actually reside. Does an agent have to peek in there? If the garage door is closed, and again, this is another hypothetical factual situation that we don't have here, they are not going to go into or look into the garage. If the garage door is open and the vehicle is partway out, and this is how many hypotheticals we can have, Justice.
Well, we have to think about that. I mean, I know hypotheticals can be troublesome.
And I don't like them because they depend on facts we don't have.
They do, but we're trying to define dwelling here, right? And it has to be a meaning that the purpose is reflected in the statute, including the entire context of the statute. And then when we look at what meaning you're advocating, I think it's fair to try to ascertain how that would apply in different situations. So I hear you saying as long as the doors – I forget the door being open or closed. That's a whole other thing. But you're relying on some kind of determination by repossession companies with respect to whether someone's actually living in the home. The garage, it's in order to take out a car of a garage. Right?
And if I might, Justice, we're defining more than just dwelling. We know the definition of dwelling. The sentence and the phraseology here is dwelling used by the customer as a residence in a case where we have a separate ground floor where nobody lives and resides, and it's only got space for 56
Right. Counsel,
customers.
Though, that's the dispute here is what that phrase means, right? Couldn't that phrase also mean, when you say used by the customer as a residence, to distinguish instead from a place where the person might park their car at someone else's house, at a friend's house, to try to perhaps even avoid a repossession?
Justice, under that hypothetical, if the customer parked at a different house, dwelling, garage, whatever you wish to call it, that house would not be used by the customer as a residence. So
right.
I kind of steer clear of that or step away from that for the purpose of this case. So that's we do have to look at the entire phrase. What we get into and what I believe the Court of Appeals did mistakenly was throughout their analysis, they ignored used by the customer as a residence. Then they took the term dwelling, and this is part of the argument, now it's typical here, I'll jump around, I was going to get to it later, but the Court of Appeals then took an administrative code provision that was issued by the DFI and that said we are only going to apply this provision to statute 422.419. Nothing to do with 425.206, nothing to do with entering a dwelling used by the customer as a residence. And in that DFI regulation, they decided to include the term garage in with the dwelling. Neither the DFI in this case, in this statute, nor the legislature chose to make such a determination. And quite frankly, if you take the DFI term of garage, then you are changing this statute to say dwelling used by the customer as a residence and the garage in which the plaintiff lived, because that's the only way you can, that's the bottom line if you get to that point of trying to insert 422.419, the regulatory provision, and then completely swap it over to 425.206, where that clearly was not the intent, and it wasn't done.
Counsel, and, on the administrative rule piece, it certainly doesn't settle, you know, the matter. But whenever an administrative rule is promulgated, as long as it's done lawfully, it is a definition of a statutory term that has to be within the scope of permissible readings of that statutory term. It wouldn't change the meaning to be something different than it would ordinarily mean, or else it'd be an unlawful administrative rule, because you would be promulgating a rule in contravention of the statutory language. So would you at least agree that that is a permissible definition of dwelling?
I think in the context of the statute for which it was used, that is, what can be placed in a lender's contract, yes, it's permissible.
Your argument, I understand your argument in terms of used by the customer as a residence, but it doesn't say the room used by or set of rooms, you know, that one actually dwells in. One of the things that interested me in this, you know, very interesting question, so I went back a little bit into kind of historical uses of dwelling. And if you go back to Black's Law Dictionary from the time, the dwelling wasn't itself a separately defined term, but it defined, they had dwelling house. And it was defined as the house in which a man lives, this is in the 1968 edition. The house in which a man lives with his family, a residence, abode, habitation, the apartment or building or group of buildings occupied by a family as a place of residence. And then in the 1979 edition of Black's, it also defines it as the house or other structure in which a person or persons live, a residence, abode, habitation, the apartment or building or group of buildings occupied by a family as a place of residence. Which would seem to, if you plug that in there, it would, an apartment building with an underground garage or a single family home with a with an attached garage, at the very least, would seem to be a building where somebody lives, and that could be a consistent reading with the statutory language. I understand that's not the one you're offering, but I'd like you to respond to that, if you would.
Well, one, the definition of dwelling that we look at was, and it was in that context, but in all of those definitions, it says where the people live, and we combine that with residence, where the definition over time comes in as where one actually lives. And so we distinguish that because a 56, and this goes into our argument in the brief about how it's the individual in a single family home perhaps, but not in this garage, has the only sole ability for in and out, and that's part of their home or dwelling.
But just to be clear, I mean, if you go back to this language, at least as the word seemed to have been generally understood, and you know, there's other statutes that use this as well, but it was not the portion of a building where you live. It was the building or apartment or group of buildings that you use as a residence. So it doesn't seem like, both as a matter of reason to me or as a matter of kind of the normal usage in the law, that dwelling, even dwelling used as a residence, I guess it says what kind of dwelling it is, but it doesn't necessarily suggest to me that dwelling means only the portions of building that you live in. And that's what I see you arguing.
And that's a portion of the argument in this factual setting with a multi-story apartment building where it's undisputed that no one lives on that floor. Access to the actual place where you live is at least one, if not two floors above, and accesses two keys, and virtually anyone can go into that ground floor area, whereas nobody can go into your residence that you use without your permission and without your keys. And it's kind of an overflow, Justice, but I think that's the reasoning, and I quite frankly, I think that's why the legislature set it as it did, dwelling where the customer, or the customer actually uses as a residence, because garage is separately defined. Garage is where vehicles are parked and stored. And the legislature, knowing full well that the section above it refers to self-help repossession of vehicles, could and would have, I think, entered garage had they intended to exclude repossession agents from coming into any building like this. Again, the single-family dwelling is a separate and I think factually distinguishable here, but I'm as you can tell, Justice, I'm focusing on the multi-unit, all the people that can come in and out of this area, and it's not really a residence where this customer, or it's not really a dwelling where this customer resides. It's a separate, you pay separately for the parking space, you use that as your parking space.
Could you address Ms. Duncan's argument that, well, perhaps the garage in its entirety is not a dwelling she uses as part of or as her residence, but that particular spot where her car was parked is part of her residence?
And I disagree with that, because with that argument, Justice, because it's part of one of 56, and she doesn't – parking a car, at least in the definitions we look at, is not living, sleeping, utilizing it as a residence. It's an adjunct item there, so that I, quite frankly, equate that to a separate parking space she might rent somewhere else, even if it was outside.
What if it was part of her, she owned it? I mean, what if she owned a condominium that included, as part of the ownership, her space?
Condominiums with ownership, and it's a one single spot, that could be different, Justice.
Why?
Well, because of the ownership aspect, and she owns just that spot. Now, with that said, we did cite, and I can't remember the case law or the case name, but we cited case law in this realm in our brief that specifically allowed for the removal of cars from condominium-assigned parking spots. And the reasoning there, and here in Wisconsin, we've just never gotten to it, but there it was still legal because it was in a multi-parking spot area and therefore not exclusive. And that was a big language, and you may recall that the Judge Elke in the trial court emphasized the exclusive ability to use and be present there, whereas in that condo hypothetical you're using in our situation.
Right, a condo here, with 56 spaces in an underground spot where no residence is on the first floor and it's underneath the. So I'm just trying to understand how you're distinguishing that.
Well, I don't know that it is different for the purpose of a parking spot being a dwelling used by the customer as a residence when it's so separated as we're talking about. What I'm saying is you asked the question about a condo. We're dealing with a single rental space. Condo, I think if this were a condo building, I think you'd hear me arguing the same thing, that there's 56 people down there. It's not a dwelling where that people use as a residence. It's a parking facility.
So what is your definition? I think this falls on what your definition of reside is.
Reside, just as we take out of the definition, the residence. Residence is where one resides. I have to take that first step. And then one resides, the residence is, as we look through it, where an individual actually lives and eats and sleeps.
I eat in my car. I've eaten in my car in my garage sometimes.
Right.
I mean, this morning I didn't. I rode my bike. But people eat in their garages in their cars. People might sleep in their garages, in their cars. I mean, I understand the frustration with all the hypotheticals, and I don't wish all the hypotheticals on you today, but I think that's just the type of case this is.
But I'm having a hard time understanding, like, where do you get that definition? And with that every time you define something, every one of us is going to say, you know, we've done it in our garage probably, or someone else's.
Well, I guess I'm that may hypothetically be true again. In this case, it was clear and confirmed, and it's undisputed. No one did any of those things in this garage. There was no indication, there's no indicia of residing or living in this garage. And so, hypothetically, if we go down that road, Justice, okay, so we all eat in our cars once in a while. Some of us try and finish the McDonald's we have in our car in the garage before we go in and get caught in the house. And so we're eating in the garage, but we're not living or technically actually residing in the garage. And so I think it's the total picture as shown by the facts and the record in this case that no one lived there. And I think Judge Elke at the trial court focused on all of that and properly understood that and properly ruled.
So you're saying that if you're not eating in the garage or sleeping in the garage, you're not residing in the garage? Is that how you're defining it?
Well, we're defining it more than that, because remember, in the record here, there is no indicia of anyone living, sitting, staying, spending time there other than getting cars, eating, sleeping, bathing.
And I don't want to get too like metaphysical about this, but everyone is living when they're in the garage. I mean, unless someone has passed away, right? Like, she is living. When she's there, she is living.
Okay, well, she is a living human being.
Well, yeah, I mean, she's right.
living
home. She's right, like, right? I mean, it is part of the experience. Right. When you pull into the garage or you pull into your driveway, you know, home sweet home, you are living there. So I'm not understanding where you're drawing the line.
Well, in this case, I'm drawing the line that in dwelling used by the customer as a residence, she's not dwelling down there. I'm circling back on the entire definition used by the customer as a residence. She's pulling in there. It's used to park her car. And so we don't have any facts in this case that indicate that she eats, sleeps, sits in her car, spends time down there as living. She is a living human being, but I think we've got to separate living in terms of dwelling, residence, the customer, and more importantly, definition of a garage being completely separate from being a dwelling or a residence.
Counsel, will you talk about 422.419 sub 1A and explain how it makes sense that under that section you can't enter into a contract that allows for repossessing a car from a garage, yet your argument is that it can be under 425.206 sub 2 sub B repossessed from a garage.
The DFI code that you're talking about and
Correct.
422 are focused on the contractual language and whether or not it's legal to put terms in a contract. And quite frankly, that statute is completely different than 425.206, which does not preclude anybody. Well, it basically precludes them from going into a different definition, dwelling used by the customer as a residence. So I separate the two and argue, obviously, that DFI, when they did their regulation, was solely indicated in context of a contract. I do separate that, and you may disagree with me, Justice, but I separate that from the independent self-help repossession statute that dictates where you can and cannot go, not what you can or cannot put in a contract. Because as an example, if that's in a contract, then a plaintiff has an action potentially under 422.419, and then all of the trappings that go along with that, including the potential avoidance of that contract.
You can't put it in a contract, but you can do it anyway. Under the self-repossession.
As a term of your agreeing to a loan, accepting funds, and a lender.
As long as it's not in the contract. So don't put it in the contract. That means you can do it.
You can enter a structure, a facility, a space that is not a dwelling used by the customer as a residence. 422.19 doesn't say anything about use as a residence, and that's another reason I think it's distinguishable.
Counsel, would you maybe in your remaining time love to hear you discuss the second issue?
Okay.
In particular, and I'm going to kick you off. You have a strong textual argument. The argument against that position is it sure seems odd that you would not, you'd be able to sort of kick this off to a third party, and then that the individual in this situation wouldn't be able to raise that kind of claim. Would you just take a moment and address
right.
that and anything else you
Quick,
want to?
Quickly yeah. on the unconscionability claim, where the federal courts and the appellate court here in the state have confirmed, based on the scope language in the specific statute, that only applies to actions commenced by a creditor, not even a repossession agent. And so my argument there is, if you look at the scope language, as the cases, as the courts did in Gable, Real, Security Finance, and Van Hus, all of those opinions confirmed that the scope language at the front end of 422.100, which leads to 107, says that it just cannot be done, and it should not be done. It's a defensive mechanism available when a lender does something unconscionable in the contract process.
I'm wondering if Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, I heard her, I'm wondering if she has a question to ask that you could answer briefly for her. I'm not sure if she does or not, but I heard her unmuted.
Yes, thank you. Counsel, at the outset of your argument, you set forth what must have been to you important facts. You set three or four important facts at the very outset, and one of those was the parking spot was obtained separately from the rental lease. If the facts were different and the parking spot was obtained with the rental lease, as a part of the rental lease, would your argument be different? And if not, why did you highlight that fact?
Chief, may I answer that? Because my
yes, you should.
Okay, thank you. Justice Bradley, my answer would, quite frankly, it would not be different. If it was part of a rental agreement for an apartment, I still would be advocating that separate area, that separate facility, was not part of the dwelling used as a residence. I find it significant as one of many facts in this case that the trial court relied on and that I think are important here. So it's one of the many facts taken in total that I believe is important. If we were solely talking about the issue of rental versus part of the apartment rent, I would still be arguing it's separate from the apartment and not part of the residence used as a dwelling.
Okay, thank you. All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Pagel?
May it please the court, as I said, I am attorney Brian Pagel, and I represent the plaintiff respondent, Danielle Duncan, in this matter. Ms. Duncan comes into this court asking this court to uphold the Court of Appeals opinion with respect to the illegality of the repossession from her garage, and asking this court to find for the first time that people such as Ms. Duncan have the affirmative right to sue creditors, merchants, and their agents who engage in unconscionable behavior or subject them to unconscionable results. In doing so, Ms. Duncan is simply asking that this court enforce the intent of the legislature in passing the Wisconsin Consumer Act, a law that was originally drafted by combined teams of merchants and customers who determined that these laws were best for both sides. for both the merchants and the consumers, and based on that, ask the legislature to pass these laws. And since the middle of the last century, these laws have protected Wisconsin consumers far more than any other consumer protection laws in any other state. It's been repeatedly stated that the Wisconsin Consumer Act goes further to provide consumer protection than any other law in any other state.
Council in Kalal, we rejected the idea that our job is to look for legislative intent, which I've always found to be an impossibility because a legislature is a body of many people who might have intended very different things in enacting a law. I think our job is to look at statutory meaning, and I'm very focused on the meaning of dwelling and also what it means to have a dwelling that is used by the customer as a residence. So for me, could you address your best argument that your client used her parking space as a residence?
Yes, I will, Justice. I think that in order to examine this question, one cannot separate portions of a residence from other portions of a residence. The defendant's petitioners repeatedly tried to emphasize that Ms. Duncan did not eat or sleep in the garage, but that is not the question. The question is whether the garage is part of her dwelling. And each room, each space within a dwelling has its own unique purpose.
Was this part of the lease?
I'm sorry?
Was it a separate lease for the parking space?
She had to enter into a separate lease for the parking space because not all tenants were required to do so, but only residents of the building were allowed to lease spaces in this garage, and the garage was functionally a part of the building. It was not separated in any way. It was coterminous with the walls of the larger residence.
Right, but unlike a single-family residence, for example, where your garage is just part of the residence, this is a separate and distinct contract dealing with a parking space that she did or she didn't have to enter into, but she chose to, right?
That is correct. To be able to park her car in the garage, Ms. Duncan had to enter into a separate contract to lease the space. But even if she had not leased a space within the parking garage, she would have been allowed to use the space encompassed by the parking garage, for example, for entry and egress into the building. So she was not prohibited from going into the garage, and therefore the garage remained part of her residence in that sense, in that she had access to it as a result of the fact that she dwelt in that building.
So is every common area of an apartment a dwelling or a residence?
Any area in an apartment building that a customer has legal access to use in a personal, family, or household purpose would be considered part of their dwelling, yes. So if you had a common area, a game room, a fitness room, an indoor swimming pool, for example, all of those would be considered part of a residence or a dwelling used as a residence.
Like some apartment areas, you can sort of pull up in the front and just pick up your mail or, you know, pull. They have a awning or something. You can just pull up and run in quick or temporarily just park your vehicle. That would be a common area that would be protected, too, under your theory.
That common area would not be protected any more than a car would be on a single-family home garage. That's open to the public to enter. It's not an enclosed space and does not present the same concerns that are being protected by 425-206 sub 2s A and B. The protections afforded by 425-206 2 A and B is primarily, and this comes from Hollabush versus Ford Motor Company, to protect against a breach of the peace. And what the statute expressly says there is that no merchant at any time, any place in the world can repossess a vehicle subject to the Consumer Act if that repossession is done in breach of the peace. And then as sub B, it sets out a second provision that defines, in this instance, a specific type of conduct that always breaches the peace, and that is entry into a dwelling used by the customer as a residence. And the reason that that is separately set out is because the inherent conduct in entering a person's residence is so likely to lead to the risk of violence and to the result that the customer would have to use force to avoid the repossession.
But wouldn't that be true if the repossession agent had entered the garage of a friend of the person whose car was being repossessed?
That may also be true in the sense that the friend in this instance might be deemed to react violently, but that is not something that the statute has chosen to protect because that's outside of the ambit of protecting the customer. The Wisconsin Consumer Act doesn't seek to protect people who are not engaged in the immediate transaction or at risk in the immediate transaction.
Well, I think a person could react the same way whether the repossession is occurring in her own apartment garage or in the garage of a friend of hers, right?
And I'm sorry, Justice Bradley, are you suggesting that the person reacting is the consumer who owns the vehicle, but
yes,
the vehicle is in the friend's garage?
Correct.
If Ms. Duncan, in this case, were to have parked her vehicle in a friend's garage and interrupted Mr. Strandley during the repossession and objected to the repossession, under 425-206-2A, that repossession would have been in breach of the peace and would have had to stop. Again, that's the Hollabush case. If Ms. Duncan were not present and later learned that Mr. Strandley had entered her friend's garage and repossessed the vehicle, because she does not use her friend's dwelling as a residence, that would not have violated 425-206-2A or B. Did that answer your question?
You seem to have been making a distinction about breach of peace that could occur at somebody's home as part of a purpose behind the legislation. So that's what I was trying to get at. That could occur anywhere.
It can, and I am, in fact, making that distinction. And the distinction that I'm making is because the legislature has prohibited two exact kinds of repossessions. And one is if a breach of the peace occurs. And that's a repossession interrupted by a simple oral protest even by a consumer. A consumer who simply says, no, I don't want you far, that under Hollabush is a breach of the peace. But what the sub 2B of 425-206 instructs is that entry into the dwelling used by the customer as a residence is essentially inherently a breach of the peace, whether the customer is present or not.
Counsel, could you help us out with how you would want us to state the holding in this case on this first issue? As you see it, there's a lot of maybe complicated questions about whether, you know, the shed or the barn or the open parking lot or other sorts of things are, you know, a dwelling used as a residence under your view. So if we ruled for you, how would you frame the holding that this was that this parking garage was part of the dwelling used as a residence because what?
The parking garage in this instance was part of Ms. Duncan's dwelling used as a residence because it was encased entirely within the four walls of and was accessible by her as a result of her legal right to reside in that building. And it was generally, as a final qualifier, it was generally excluded from access by people who did not have a legal right to be on the premises. And I think that's one of the key questions here is, when you talk about open parking lot versus enclosed parking garage that is part of the building, it's true that as a result of there being 56 parking spots in this building, any one of the other 55 residents who had a parking spot could have allowed someone into the garage. But that is true of any dwelling used as a residence. If you have a single family home with an attached garage and you have a husband and a wife living in there, both of those people have a right to access the garage and both have a right to allow someone else to access the garage. Notwithstanding that, a third party lacks the right to access the garage entirely. Now, with an open-air parking lot, at the very least, that same protection is not there for two reasons. One, you don't need to have legal right to access, or as in this case, a key or remote control to get into the garage. And two, the risk of potential violence from confronting someone in the open air is less than the risk of potential violence from confronting someone within a structure you view as being your own home.
What's your best sort of statutory argument for defining dwelling as the single building upon which it's all encased?
Well, partially that makes it somewhat circular. If you look at the definitions, because the legislature did not define them, we repeatedly see things that dwellings are houses, houses are where people reside, the residence is where you dwell. I think what you're looking at is when the legislature doesn't define a term, we're going to what the average person would understand the common meaning of the word to be. And in that, I default to first the Platonic ideal of a dwelling, which I think is the single family home with attached garage. I think if you ask 100 people, 100 out of 100 would say a single family home with attached garage is a dwelling.
The Platonic ideal, I love that. Anyway, keep going. Yes.
Counsel, if the person who took the car out of her garage were not the repossession agency that did this, but I don't know, the municipality in which she lived, and they took it out of her garage thinking that it might have been a car involved in an accident. Would the city have a right to, or the municipality have a right to do that if they had a warrant to get the car? Could they come and get it out of her garage?
Yes, they would. I think that's an appropriate distinction to draw here because the circuit court in this case relied on a Seventh Circuit Fourth Amendment case in determining that Ms. Duncan, in the circuit court's opinion, did not have a reasonable expectation of privacy. But when you're dealing with municipal or government enforcement and Fourth Amendment rights, you're dealing with a different set of factors and considerations than you are when you're considering the private balance between a merchant and their repossession agent and a customer.
Do you think the Fourth Amendment would be more or less stringent than this customer relationship?
The Fourth Amendment is less stringent than the customer relationship in this case.
Are you familiar with our State versus Dempsey opinion that dealt with almost this identical situation, except it was 30 apartment units instead of this number?
I apologize for not being immediately familiar with this statement. If you would like me to address it, I would certainly do so if you can give me some guidance.
Well, in that case, anyway, the court concluded that the parking garage underneath the apartment building was not curtilage of the home, and then it went through a variety of factors to ascertain whether or not that was something that would be akin to a home or entry of a home, warrantless entry. I just wondered if you were familiar with that, because the court has analyzed the context of apartment garage access and discussed a number of expectations, privacy and otherwise, and factors in making the determination that in Dempsey, the parking garage underneath the apartment building, which had 30 apartments in it, was not, something that he had this expectation of privacy, among other things, in.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I appreciate that explanation, and I think the Dempstra explanation is consistent with what the Seventh Circuit held in the Sweeney case, the circuit court considered here, and consistent with my own opinion that the Fourth Amendment is a different analysis than the analysis of whether this is a dwelling used by the customer as a residence. I think when you're talking about a search under a warrant, you're talking about a situation where a judicial officer has already reviewed the facts of the matter and determined that there is at least probable cause to proceed with investigating in there. In this case...
Right. If it's warrantless, though. Let's assume it's warrantless.
If it's warrantless, you still have constitutional protections against unreasonable intrusions. And one of the things in this case is that the statute, 425-206-2B, makes it an unreasonable intrusion for a private person to go into a dwelling used by the customer as a residence. And so I think the analysis under the Fourth Amendment of curtilage and whether the parking garage is part of the curtilage or has an expectation of privacy is different for several reasons. First, there is statutory protection here. Secondly, you're talking about protecting different interests. With a warrantless search or a warranted search, you're talking about the balance, the government's need to enforce the laws versus an individual's expectation of privacy in certain areas. Here, what you're talking about balancing is a merchant's need to repossess collateral against a customer's need to have integrity of their dwelling. And I think that when you balance those, it's fair to say that the customer concerned with the integrity of her dwelling has a greater right to be protected against the merchant because the merchant is not bound by any government authority. They're not getting prior approval to go through because they're not seeking a judicial replevin order. And they're engaging in an action that is less societally beneficial. They are seeking to encourage only their own private interests as opposed to the enforcement of public laws. And so I think those two analyses do not dovetail.
Counsel, I heard you respond to Justice Hagedorn about your definition of dwelling. Do you consider at all the Wisconsin Administrative Code provision in 1.392 as related to 422.419 sub 1A? And if you do, how do you mesh that with the definition that you just gave about dwelling?
Thank you, Justice. I do consider that, and I think, to put it as simply as I can, the DFI got it right. Section 422.419, as you yourself indicated earlier, prohibits a merchant from inserting a contractual right to enter a dwelling. And the Department of Financial Institutions has said dwelling includes garage. The DFI, in fact, expands it beyond even the definition I've given here today. But in that instance, as you yourself noted, if a merchant cannot contract to gain the right, it would be, I think, an inconsistent and absurd result to then say they nonetheless have that right at all.
Well, counsel, what the statute talks about is they cannot waive an objection to entering their residence. That doesn't mean that, done correctly, you couldn't enter someone's residence. I don't think that's the circumstance that we have here. I think that the Consumer Protection Act has its own provisions, and they're in two different places, and they're different kinds of provisions. In other words, you can say, well, you know, you can't waive the right to object to how someone takes your collateral, but that's different from saying you can never take the collateral that way. Do you see what I'm saying? I think that the DFI provision that's used talks about what you can't give up when you're getting money for a transaction or credit for a transaction. You can't be asked to give this up. But that doesn't mean that if taking the collateral in a legally proper way is still not okay. In other words, you can't waive things in advance so that you couldn't object later on. And I think that the contractual provisions keeps the creditor from overreaching on someone that needs credit and making them waive things that might be unreasonably done later on. But I don't think that if they're reasonably done, that has a whole lot to, as long as you didn't contractually waive your right to object, I don't see any inconsistency with legally proceeding on it in a way you couldn't waive the right to proceed on. Does that make sense to you?
I do see the point you're making,
yeah.
Your Honor, but I think the key question there is you're using the second portion, you're saying proceed in a legal manner.
Well, sure.
So everyone agrees that at this point, Wells Fargo could not, as a matter of extending the original loan to Ms. Duncan, ask her or force her to sign a contract that would give them permission to enter her dwelling. And the DFI has said that for purposes of that contractual provision, dwelling includes her garage. So in this instance, Wells Fargo could not have said to Ms. Duncan, we will lend you money, but if you park your car in your building's garage, we still have the right to come get it.
That's right. They couldn't waive that right. And then if they're going to come and get the car, then we end up in court like we are now, determining whether what they did was correct or not. I mean, she could have had a parking space that was in a closed outside garage. I mean, there are many garages where you have to have, not garages, but parking places where you have to have a key to get into an outside lot. So that would be a different factual circumstance, and whether you would think the results were the same or not, I don't know. I'm not great on hypotheticals. I like to have all the facts before I have to make a legal decision. But I do think you can't require someone who's asking for credit to waive certain rights that they might want to raise and have a real reason to raise later on. To me, that's a very different circumstance. And I think that the provision that's in the administrative rules had to do with contracting. They didn't want people to have to give up rights in order to get credit. Okay, so give them up so you could never say, oh, they did this unreasonably. And specifically, the section we're talking about says, for purposes of 422.419 1A. So it limits the term dwelling and where it is to have that meaning. And I think it goes to what you can't contract around. Doesn't say anything at all about 425.206.
And I agree that neither 422.419 nor the DFI administrative regulation directly reference 425.206, but if you will indulge me with a hypothetical just maybe one more time, if you hypothesize a situation where Wells Fargo tells Ms. Duncan, we'll lend you the money, but in exchange we want a clause in the contract that says we can enter your apartment garage to collect the vehicle if you default. And then the exact events that occur here took place, that Mr. Strandley enters the garage. Under those circumstances, Ms. Duncan would have come into court, and presumably this court would have said, well, that contract provision is clearly illegal, but the action that was taken pursuant to the contract provision is not. And
well,
but
you see, if you prevail today, as you did at the Court of Appeals, you would be right. If you lose today, however, you would be wrong, right? So that's the problem with hypothetical.
That is the ultimate hypothetical.
In order to go along with what you said, which I don't disagree with your reasoning, you have to prevail. Okay, if you don't prevail and we say, no, that's not what it means, the Court of Appeals was wrong, then to have that contractual provision may not have been unlawful. Okay, so I have problems with hypotheticals, so I'm a bad one to try those on.
Mr. Pagel, were you going to respond?
Have I answered your question, Justice?
You did. Yes, you
Thank
did.
You.
Thank you.
I want to give you an opportunity to talk about the unconscionability portion of your case. And I think I'll start out with the question of, are you arguing that going into the garage, if we find that the garage was, in fact, a dwelling, are you arguing that that in and of itself would be unconscionable, or is your unconscionability claim focusing on what happened after the car was repossessed?
The unconscionability claim in this case includes both what we contend is the illegal repossession from the garage, as well as what I've called the post-repossession conduct, which in short was conduct that dissuaded Ms. Duncan from exercising her statutory right to redeem the property. Without delving too deeply into the facts, Ms. Duncan has testified that the conduct she was subjected to by asset recovery dissuaded her from first obtaining her personal property and then dissuaded her from exercising her statutory right to redeem by paying nearly 2 months' wages to redeem the vehicle because she was not allowed to view it to ensure it had not been damaged during the repossession process. And so our contention is that even if this court were to find the repossession itself was lawful, the court could conclude that because Ms. Duncan's legal rights were violated with respect to her redemption, that the result of that conduct was unconscionable under 425.107, and the court could then take action to limit or refuse to enforce the transaction. And one of the reasons why even lawful conduct can be the subject of an unconscionability claim is that under 425.107, the statute specifically says, I believe it's at sub 4, that the fact that conduct is allowed by the Wisconsin Consumer Act does not in and of itself mean that that conduct cannot form the basis for a claim of unconscionability. So under those circumstances, even a lawful repossession could be deemed unconscionable if the court in its discretion deemed that to be unconscionable. But when coupled with the post-repossession conduct of refusing to allow Ms. Duncan to view her vehicle, of refusing at first to give her an amount even to allow her to redeem the vehicle, a statutory right she undisputedly has, we believe that the court could then take steps to limit the unconscionable result of that transaction.
I want to make sure that I understood what you said, if I could just ask a follow-up question. So you are saying that even if we were to find that the garage was not part of her dwelling, that we could still find that the repossession itself was unconscionable? Did you say that?
No.
I'm glad I asked.
I apologize for being unclear. So we are asking that this court determine that the repossession was illegal. But if this court determines that the repossession was legal, then the circuit court can still take into account the circumstances of the repossession as part of the continuum of conduct under 425.107.4. Has that clarified?
Yes, very much. Thank I appreciate
you.
It.
What Thank do you, you make, counsel, of the fact that subchapter I or 1, under which 425.107 resides, is titled Creditor's Remedies? So above that, that's the heading under which this unconscionability claim falls.
I think that the title itself has little indication of how the statute should be exercised, especially in light of 425, 302, and 303, which grant in particular that every right or obligation under the Wisconsin Consumer Act may be enforced by action. 425.107 is indisputably a statute that confers both rights and obligations. It tells consumers they have a right to be free from any unconscionable conduct or any aspect of a transaction that's unconscionable. It tells creditors and merchants that they are required to refrain, they are obliged to refrain from acting in an unconscionable way. And so under the prevailing interpretation given by the federal courts and the one-judge opinion in Security Finance, that statute is effectively written out because a customer does not have an affirmative right to bring an action to enforce her rights under 425.107 or enforce the obligations of the consumer. And I think if you look at the specific proceedings, 425, I want to say it's 102, but I may not be right about that offhand. It says that the subchapter applies to actions and other proceedings by creditors. And we've dealt with this more in detail in our brief, but we know what an action is. An action is a legal action. An other proceeding, by definition, has to be something other than a legal action, because if you say an other proceeding is a legal action, you've just made that redundant with actions. Now, under Chapter 801, the rules of civil procedure apply to actions and special proceedings. Special proceedings are not other proceedings. So this court has to say, well, what are other proceedings? And other proceedings are, in this case, actions that creditors take outside of court to enforce their rights. So when a creditor seeks a remedy outside of court, such as non-judicial repossession, or any of the actions the DFI has declared inherently falsely issuing credit cards, that creditor is taking an action to enforce its rights. It's taking a, quote, other action.
So let me ask this. Was 425.102 in place prior to this non-judicial remedy, though? This came later, correct? You used to have to go through a court. So you're saying the meaning of other proceedings means something that when it was enacted didn't exist yet?
No, I'm saying that other proceedings when it was enacted did exist because there were additional things that could take place to enforce consumer credit transactions outside of court, including voluntary surrender, for example. At the time of enactment of the Consumer Act, a creditor could take a voluntary surrender of a vehicle but could not initiate an attempt to voluntarily surrender the vehicle. In other words, a creditor cannot say to Ms. Duncan, would you like to voluntarily surrender your vehicle? That was true at the passage of the Consumer Act and is true today. And if she surrenders it in response to a request or demand, it's an illegal voluntary surrender.
So your argument, counsel, is that seeking repossession of the vehicle here was an other action, other proceeding brought by a creditor.
It was an other proceeding undertaken by a creditor is the phrase I would use.
Yes, but statutorily, the word, that's not the verb that's in the statute. The verb in the statute is brought. And that seems to be a different sort of thing than undertaken. Right? It has to be something brought by a creditor.
But sticking then with the strict text of the statute, I still think an other proceeding brought by a creditor can be a non-judicial repossession. It's under creditors' remedies. Non-judicial repossession is clearly a remedy creditors have now, and so this statute applies to that. And Section 425.107 would then apply to the other proceeding of the non-judicial repossession.
Well, repossession may be an action that a creditor would take. It seems odd to think that repossession in this context would be a proceeding brought by a creditor. That doesn't seem to square with those words.
I've been using the word action in the sense of legal action, and I think that's the most straightforward way to interpret that. I think when you look at other proceedings brought by a creditor, I don't think the statute itself indicates that those proceedings must be, quote unquote, brought in a formal manner. Because, again, if you do that, if you say the proceeding must be brought in the sense that we bring a lawsuit, what you're doing essentially is writing other proceedings right back out of the statute, because you don't bring anything but a lawsuit or a special proceeding under the rules of civil procedure. But we have analogized it to under, for example, Chapter 128, there is an other proceeding that's in this case is liquidation. And liquidation is something that a creditor can force a debtor to do under Chapter 128. That would be an other proceeding the creditor brings. And I think in that sense, they're looking at brought as bringing against the person, as opposed to the formal act of, for example, filing a lawsuit.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Well, I've got bullet points here, and I know I'm short on time, so I want to hit on a couple of things. First of all, kind of going backwards based on what Justice Hagedorn was just talking with counsel about. Justice, if you're talking about proceedings brought would not include a repossession, and all I rely on there is the case law in particular. If one reads the Gable, which conveniently counsel and I lived through together for a couple of years, with regard to the ability of a plaintiff to affirmatively assert unconscionability. That was a repossession action with behavior alleged on the part of the repossession agents as well as the lender being involved. And the court there in the reasoning makes it clear, again, going back to the scope argument and the scope of that, why a plaintiff does not have the right to bring an independent, separate, standalone action for unconscionability under 425.107. I wanted to follow up on something.
Before you leave that issue, counsel,
yes.
I have a question for you. What about 425.301 sub 2, which says any right or obligation declared by chapters 421 to 427 is enforceable by action unless the provision declaring it specifies a different and limited effect, and 425.107.5 says the customer shall be entitled upon a finding of unconscionability to recover from the creditor a remedy.
I think 425.102, the scope, does limit, as referenced in the statute you just mentioned, okay? The availability of remedies under 425.300 in those sections exists upon a finding of unconscionability. That does not say that a plaintiff or a customer can bring an action. Basically, there can be a finding of unconscionability in the review of a contract that the lender is trying to enforce. And part of the important part of that is the unconscionability talks also about extortionate extensions of credit. That statute is on the behavior of the lender in contracting and then trying to enforce a contract. Once the lender then comes in and brings an action to enforce the contract, the plaintiff or the customer can 425.107 as a defense upon a finding of that defense unconscionability, then basically the contract is unenforceable. And that's how that dovetails. Is that
yes,
good enough? Okay. Justice Rosenczak had mentioned something about 422, 419 and distinguished the reasoning in waiving. One of the things I wanted to dovetail with that, Justice, is that the DFI is overseeing the Consumer Act. It's overseeing all of the statutes relating to merchants and creditors and customers from 421 to 427. In 422, 419, they decided solely to add their definition of dwelling. They could have very well done that in 425.206 sub 2 just as easily, and they clearly made the decision not to. So their definition of dwelling is limited, and I think that's what the discussion was, is limited to 422.419. And they say it is. They say it's limited solely to that statute. So that was another aspect. To follow up, and I think it kind of stands as rebuttal in light of a couple of the arguments, but I wanted to hit with regard to There was a discussion about dumpster, and I think that talks about what's part of a home and what's not, what's part of a dwelling. Following up, with regard to statutes, I wanted to finish with citation to State versus Richards, a 1985 case. This court's rule is to apply statutes as they are written by the legislature, not to find requirements which appear nowhere within the four corners of the statute. That's exactly what the Court of Appeals did by going to 422.419. That also seems to appear to be the argument when the plaintiff here is trying to insert the term garage into 425.206.2b when it doesn't exist, and at the same time trying to remove the definitive phrase used by the customer as a residence. That would go right in the face, I think, of that reasoning in State v. Richards. One more, there's State X. Rel. Badke versus School Board 1. If the plaintiff submits that the legislature meant something other than it said, the remedy is not in the courts. Modifications of statutes, if they work badly or result in unexpected and undesirable ways, must be obtained through legislative, not judicial actions. And so I think the language is clear in the statute. This was not an illegal repossession. With regard to unconscionability, I'm going to jump back on one more. The trial court looked at the fact that Ms. Duncan didn't go to check on her car or her personal possessions until 18 days after she got notice that it would be sold. It was gone already when she got there. And all they did was ask, so she couldn't see her vehicle. All they did was ask her to sign an acknowledgement that she got her vehicle back. And her
thank
person.
You. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for a very good argument. The court will meet in closed conference 12:30? 1. We're going to meet at 1 this afternoon.
All right. Not 1:30?
1 o'clock. Right. We're, yes.